Hey, we've got the famous Honolulu Ramper here. First time we've ever met, although we've met, like, you know, from a distance many, many times.
Absolutely. Hello.
So this is the mystery man right here.
This is all you're going to see.
Remaining a mystery.
That's right. Absolutely.
Over the course of 14 flight operations, 7 flights in each direction between the U.S. and Australia, we found ourselves in Honolulu every single time. On a few of the projects, we encountered some technical issues, and in every case, it was due to issues with the HF radio system. This tends to be the weak link with oceanic narrowbody deliveries across the board. Fortunately, between the availability of on-site maintenance and telephonically guided troubleshooting by myself and other crew members, we were able to overcome all of these issues without significant delay. Don't get me wrong, as ferry pilots, we're not qualified as A&P mechanics, but when you've been doing this as long as we have, simple things like servicing the engine oil and opening up panels to run tests with an engineer on the other end of a phone saves time, money, and enables us to keep things on schedule in the face of adversity. Getting stranded at an outstation is not a situation that can always be rectified fast, if at all. Part of being a good ferry pilot means having a strong systems knowledge, the ability to triage mechanical issues and report the faults in detail to engineering, and experience and manual support to know what's critical and what can be safely deferred until arrival at a maintenance base. Honolulu is probably one of the most regular fuel stops we make in this business, and for good reason. The stretch of ocean between the coast of California and Hawaii is the longest oceanic stretch with no landing alternates in the world. When flying to East Asia, we sometimes skip Hawaii in favor of the shorter Great Circle route over Alaska. But once you calculate the overflight fees for Russia and Japan, as well as the logistics of acquiring overflight permissions, it's usually a wash, if not cheaper, to fly on the longer mid-pack route that involves stopovers in Hawaii, and then either Guam, Majuro, Saipan, or Samoa. Personally, I prefer to island hop anyway, as the scenery is beautiful and the air is temperate. Hawaii is also a great overnight rest location because of the abundance of hotels, the availability of great catering options, and, of course, if there's time and the crew is Ava and I, excellent golf.
This is Steve, hard at work. Par 3, 12th hole, wind's howling in our face.
On trip number 8, which was actually the first of the returns, Ava and I had to take an extended break in Honolulu due to the limited availability of outbound flights from Brisbane. The rules in Australia have changed several times, and in the case in question, we were only permitted a maximum of 4 hours transit time in Brisbane before we had to be on a flight out of the country. This set up a situation where we found ourselves with 30 hours in Honolulu. On that trip, we were able to get a tee time at Ko'olina, which is one of the nicer golf courses on Oahu, situated next to Aulani, the Disney resort. Tough life, I know. So before we get back into flying, remember HNL Ramper from the beginning of this episode? Nearly every time we pass through, he captures some great shots of our airplanes, and this batch was no different. Recommend giving him a follow on Instagram because his AvGeek photos are top-notch. Part 3 ended with John and I departing the reef runway in Honolulu westbound for the 4.5-hour trek to Majuro. The 737-800 has a bit less than 8 hours endurance, so when we transit the South Pacific, we need to stop and refuel in order to get to Australia. There aren't a ton of options, and the most typical place we quick turn is in Majuro. It's a small atoll in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it's definitely one of the most interesting visual approaches we do. We land there often, usually about 20 to 25 times per year. wasn't much to see between Honolulu and Majuro from the air, to be honest. There is one exception, though. About 90 minutes after departure, if the weather is clear and you're on R-584, you may be fortunate enough to spot Johnston Island. This incredibly remote island was once the site of a multitude of horrible things, from nuclear testing to chemical weapons storage. Johnston officially closed in 2005 and is pretty much abandoned these days, except for small teams of 10 to 15 volunteer workers at a time from the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife. Over the last 10 years, these volunteers have seasonally resided in tents on the island, cut off from the rest of the world for months at a time. I know it sounds odd, but the reason they go? To eradicate colonies of acid-spitting crazy ants. They are called Crazy Ant Strike Team, actually. Yes, I've gone down hours-long rabbit holes reading about and watching YouTube videos on the subject. Once we're about 100 miles from Majuro, we get a clearance to cruise to 10,000 from ATC via HF relay through San Francisco Airing. What this simply means is that a block of airspace between our cruising altitude and 10,000 feet is clear of traffic, and we can descend at our discretion. Once we're about 50 miles out, we make contact with the Majuro Advisory Station, which is basically a UNICOM attached to the Common Traffic Advisory Frequency. There, somebody on the ground at the airport gives us the winds, runway in use, ceiling, visibility, temperature, and the basic information about any traffic operating on the field. They can't clear us to land, however. Their role is purely as an advisory. We use this information combined with air-to-air traffic advisory with any other aircraft operating in the vicinity to determine when it's safe to approach and land. The visual approach to landing in Majuro is one of my all-time favorites. As I've said in the past, we alternate between pilot flying, PF, and pilot not flying, PNF, by the day. It's easier that way than switching our stuff from one side to the other every leg. If I'm flying with somebody that's never been to Majuro before, I always give them the leg because it's such a treat to experience. Landing in Maj is basically the closest thing we have to landing an airliner on an aircraft carrier. Surrounded on all sides by the deep blue Pacific, the atoll presents visually like a shoestring floating in the ocean. With a total landmass of 3.5 square miles, the 25-mile-long string of sand surrounds a lagoon and, in some areas, is only a couple hundred feet wide. The airport is situated on a particularly narrow stretch with the runway basically extending between two seawalls, with the main road passing just adjacent to a barrier on the south side. On days when the sea is rough, waves actually crash against the seawall and sometimes rain down salt water on the runway. There's no precision approach to either runway here. The best they've got is an RNAV GPS approach to each end that gets you to within 460 feet above the runway threshold. That said, I've never seen an extended low-vis situation in Majuro. Just brief periods of heavy rain, which tend to pass within 30 to 40 minutes. The nearest alternate is Kwajalein, located about 270 miles to the west-northwest. I've still not spent the night on this little island, although many know the story of the time two of my pilots did, for 10 days. Maybe someday, although I'm sure 2 to 3 days would be plenty.
100. 50, 40, 30, 20, 10.
Hello.
Although the airport is essentially just a runway and a small ramp with a tiny little terminal shack, they do see a good bit of activity here. United Airlines, in continuation of the old Continental Airlines Air Micronesia, or Air Mike as it was known, has regular service to and from Guam using 737s. United, albeit less frequently, serves up some nonstops to Honolulu, Chuuk, Kwajalein, and Pompeii as well. Air Marshall Islands serves a bunch of the surrounding islands with service in a Dash 8 and a pair of Dornier 228s. Air Nauru flies between here and Nauru, and Tarawa Kiribati with 737s. And then, of course, Asia Pacific Airlines with their 757 freighters haul fresh fish and other cargo. They're a regular visitor as well. Majuro sees a flurry of activity from the U.S. military, the Coast Guard, and many, many ferry flights. I'd have to imagine the sale of jet fuel is a significant contribution to the economy of the tiny island. Although I'd love to drag along a surfboard someday, our only business in Majuro is taking on fuel. Oh, and catering whenever possible. There's a little restaurant in the terminal which we pretty much have a standing order for tuna with rice. More on that later. Like most of the smaller airports we use, Majuro prefers we supervise the fuel loading. This is a simple task that requires standing on a ladder and watching the fuel quantity indicators roll up before flipping the three switches to close the refueling valves for each of our fuel tanks, the left wing, the right wing, and the center tank. We don't top up all the way here when we're heading to Brisbane, as the flight is only about 5 hours. In a 737, our average fuel uplift is about 3,700 gallons here. Because Majuro is so remote, the only way to get an IFR clearance to depart is over HF radio via relay to ATC through San Francisco. So we get our departure clearance just before engine start, with a void time of about 10 minutes later. As soon as we get that clearance, we need to move, or we'd have to get a new clearance and start all over.
All right, good start on two. There's a rollback.
Yeah, the tuna, you'd think it would be like a, you'd think it would be like raw, but they cook it. Mm-hmm. But it's still, excellent.
I mean, I got the sandwich last time, for that first time. There's a sign,
that one?
You look away. They won't even let you up there?
No, you walk near there, they start screaming, waving their arms.
Yokwe. Definitely don't want fucking COVID here. I don't blame them.
I probably have none.
I know. I mean, yeah. If they ended up getting COVID here, I mean, you know.
Oh, they're toast.
I mean, the whole island will get COVID.
Yeah.
It's crazy, man. And people live, like, in, like, these tin kind of shacky things.
Yeah.
And there's very little furniture here on the island. Like, people literally have, like, pads to sit on.
Jesus.
They bury their family in the front yard of their house.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's no graveyards.
That's true.
Crazy, right? Yeah. Nice roll, bro. It's an interesting place, and I wouldn't mind spending some time here at some point, but, you know, we all know the story of Tom and Floyd.
Oh, yeah.
Alright, my wait. Alright. Alright, is that the rush? Thrust set?
V1.
Rotate. How does it rate?
Gear up.
Gear up.
In the climb, we were able to raise San Francisco one last time on HF to give them our off time and estimates for the next two fixes. About 20 minutes after that, we checked in with Brisbane on HF, who would handle us for the remainder of the journey. Once at cruise, out came the food. It goes without saying that you can get a mighty fine piece of fish in Majuro, but the first time I opened my styrofoam container expecting a piece of bright red, raw, or at least rare piece of tuna, I was shocked to see a pale white, firm slab of fully cooked big eye. I happily gobbled it down along with the raw red onion, rice, macaroni salad, but I always wonder why. Eating a piece of well-done tuna is strange to me. Pleasant, but strange. No idea why this is done, but maybe one day I'll get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, it's tuna steak with a lime, some rice, and we're really looking forward to eating it. Some red onions.
The last leg of this project is normally the worst with regard to weather. The late afternoon equatorial thunderstorms over the South Pacific can be nasty, and having good weather radar is essential. The process for dodging storms in oceanic airspace is similar to what we do in radar coverage, and actually a bit easier. When the weather radar starts painting a system of cells, we determine how much space we need laterally to dodge these cells, and then make a request for an offset. We could either request so many miles left or right of track, or even both left and right, for that matter. It's not uncommon for us to request as much as 50 miles in both or either direction. Once ATC approves the offset, we just fly the heading bug in whatever zigzag course is needed to navigate around the cells. Once we're past the weather, we just report back en route. The nice bit of land we'd cross would be the Solomon Islands, and on this route, we fly right over the top of Haniara. Haniara would have made a fine fuel stop instead of Majuro, but the fuel's a bit more expensive there, and with only one aircraft, we didn't need the ramp space, so Majuro was decided for all the returns to Virgin Australia. As I mentioned previously, the timing on these return trips is always predicated on the outbound departure from Brisbane on a commercial flight. Over the course of this project, our options have been either Brisbane-Singapore JFK on Singapore Airlines or Brisbane-Doha-Philly on Qatar. Both flights depart in the evening, so on most of these flights, the sun went down within about an hour of landing in Australia. Even with the limited flight schedules during the pandemic, the early evening is really busy in Brisbane, so it was pretty common on the arrival to get slowed down about 80 miles out or vectored around in sequence behind the other commercial arrivals. John and I briefed up the approach as we descended into the terminal area. On this one, the winds were out of the north, and we received radar vectors that took us around south of the airport onto the final approach to one right. This approach took us right over the city, and though the view of the lights on the buildings and the bridges is impressive, arriving during the day is quite a bit more scenic. After landing, we dropped the jet right off at a gate at the international terminal. Of the seven return trips, only once did we land during daylight, and it was on the final delivery. In that case, there was an earlier flight out on Singapore Airlines that we just barely made. Lucky for us, on that one, we parked right next to our ride home. On this flight, the second to last one, we rode home on Qatar Airways, my favorite option. We got to the terminal about 3 hours prior to our flight out, and we were restricted from leaving the red zone because of COVID protocol. Doesn't matter how many times I've seen it, the empty terminal with only vending machines for snacks is pretty surreal.
Ready to end this, man?
Yeah.
Oh.
Qatar Airways, gate 899
yeah,
to
Durban. With a long-ass ride home.
Now boarding through gate 82.
Yeah, well, continue westbound.
By the time we boarded our flight to Doha, we were zonked, and the Q-suites were a welcome break. The 30-hour journey home passes by fast when you have enough room to stretch out on the lie-flat seats. The complimentary pajamas and the sliding door between each suite in the aisle really deliver an experience that truly rivals a private jet and at a fraction of the cost. In the end, we ferried the 7 aircraft to the United States in 2 groups, 5 at once with Ocean's 11 and 2 from Melbourne a month later. Then each of the 7 were returned after maintenance checks and paint from 4 different locations: Victorville, Goodyear, Kansas City, and Spokane. Start to finish, the 14 flights occurred over 13 months, and although we operated over 250 other flights in that time period, always having a Virgin Australia aircraft on the horizon meant always looking forward to a fun trip with good, mechanically sound airplanes. My only complaint about the project is that we never got the chance to leave the airport in Brisbane because of the pandemic. Hopefully soon the rules will relax and we can finally get out and explore the city, play some golf, and take our time getting home. Word on the street is that Virgin is taking more airplanes, so I've got my fingers crossed that we'll be back in the near future.